Welcome to the Realmcast.
Welcome to the Realmcast, Mortal Kombat Online's official podcast, the original Mortal Kombat podcast, bringing you well-known and significant members of the Mortal Kombat community. I'm your host, the Mortal Kombat Phantom, and with me as always is my co-host, our lore master, Yanni. Welcome, Yanni.
Thank you, Phantom. And today we'd like to welcome Alec Gillis, well known for his involvement with Alien and Predator, among other movies, but more specifically in the MK community for his work on Goro in the original Mortal Kombat 1995. Welcome, Alec.
Thank you guys for having me.
Hey, Alec, it's great to have you on. Yeah. Now, we definitely want to talk Mortal Kombat, but we'd like to start off kind of talking about your career outside of the Mortal Kombat universe. You've been involved in so many movies and like very high profile and classic projects, like since the time that you first started working in the industry. So, first of all, how would you describe your work specifically? I mean, do you have an official job title anymore, or is it just kind of guy who does everything?
You know, it's funny because somebody recently, well, I hear this all the time from guys, particularly guys about your age, who say, you're responsible for my childhood. Mm-hmm. And then I'm like, yep. What are you asking for, a paternity test? But it turns out that it's about my career. But no, I'm I call myself a character designer because, you know, animatronics is one aspect of it, like Goro, but another aspect might be makeup, like Pennywise in It. And then also, even if we're doing things that are far flung and not really movie related, like we work with artists on occasion. We've done some work with Banksy, doing some animatronic characters. And you always look for a character in whatever you're doing. If it's just an inanimate sculpture, you look for the expressiveness and backstory to that sculpture, whatever it may be. It might be a, you know, if we're designing a Predator mask or something, you know, you're thinking about it as an extension of character, even if it's a prop that someone's going to use or a creature's going to use. So I'm a character designer. I'm also a creature effects guy. I'm a makeup effects guy. So it becomes a little bit of an issue in credits when they say, like, what do you want to call yourself? So what I usually do is I think about it in terms of that movie and what we do for that movie, you know? But yeah, it's a lot of hats.
It's as Phantom said, it's a bit of everything. So it makes sense that you go with what it is specifically for that actual project. But what I find funny is that you always hear that from people like us that you sort of made our childhoods. In a way, I was telling Phantom that you sort of kind of ruined my childhood temporarily because I was petrified of the alien when I first saw it. Well, it was actually Aliens 3, I think it was, or Aliens 2. When I was absolutely scared, I saw it coming on TV, and I, from that moment, for so many years, I was just going nowhere near horror.
Messed you up, but that's part of what the behind the scenes stuff is good for, right? You get to see. I was similar, you know. When I was growing up, there was no information out there, very little information about how things were done, but you'd occasionally see something in Life magazine or whatever about how they did a movie monster. And it always fascinated me. And I think when I was around 11 or 12, I got to go to Don Post Studios where they make the masks. They were making the, you know, masks that I would see advertised in Famous Monsters of Filmland or what have you. And that's when I saw adults working, doing these fantastical things. And it clicked in my mind, oh, somebody does this. Some grownups do this for a living. And that's when I thought, well, why can't I do that for a living? And that's when everything opened up and sometimes people say, does it ruin it for you? Cause you know how things are done. And I say, no, it adds another level of appreciation. And I pity the people who just do this and, you know, it's having a great emotional impact on them when they're watching the movie. But, you know, they're missing out on so much more if you don't know how things are done. Or anyway, but I appreciate, that's why I appreciate the diehard fans, because they put the time into it and they eat it up, and I love that.
I think when I was around seven, I was terrified of Freddy Krueger, not one of your own creations, but and it was a similar type of story. I came across kind of a behind the scenes photo of getting the makeup done and things like that, and I said, oh, okay, this is how it's done, and it no longer worried me, and I didn't have issues. And ever since then, I've been so interested in this career of special effects.
Good.
Well, you mentioned the helmet for Predator and how you sort of approach it. I'm just curious as to how you approach monster design in general. You clearly love working with monsters, aliens, and the like, but I'm curious as to what else you consider within the design. For example, the motion, how that affects the balance, etc.
Well, it's like building a house, being a contractor who's got to build a house, but it's also like being an actor who's got to create a character based on the parameters that are in the script. So it's sort of, you have to bring those two sort of like disparate approaches together. You know, when I'm designing, and when I say when I'm designing, what that means is I've got my design team and I'm art directing, and I've got fantastic artists. I'm very fortunate to have, you know, had a long association with some really great artists. And basically, I will, you know, talk with the filmmakers, specifically the director. Preferably, the director it's all coming from the director, and not, you know, you don't have too much interference from producers and so on that might be watering down the process or sending you off in directions that are not applicable. But I get parameters from the director. The director will have ideas. A good director doesn't necessarily have to say, here's exactly what I want. I just prefer it when they come with some opinions. Tell me what you like. Tell me what you don't like, equally as important. If a director says, oh, geez, I don't know, just show me stuff. Like, on the one hand, it's kind of fun, but on the other hand, you go, okay, this is a couple of extra weeks of work, because we aren't like, you know, we're just throwing darts anywhere, you know? And that is kind of the design process, which is, I think of it as a pyramid. The base of the pyramid is where we fire out, you know, tens and dozens and, you know, many, many designs. And then the director goes, well, that one's stupid. I don't like that one. Oh, but I love this. And this is interesting somehow, you know. And then you go, okay, we're narrowing it down. And then you go up to the next level of the pyramid. And you've honed it and you've honed it and you've honed it until you get to that little shining capstone that is your final design. But yeah, in that design, you know, you're just bringing all of your understanding of visuals and sculpture, as well as, for me, I really like to draw on nature. I love things that feel like they are real and that they make sense and that they are biologically plausible. And that is usually a really good place to design from. But sometimes if you're in a more like psychological realm or psychologically disturbing realm, you have to look to sort of a different place. You're not just doing a science fiction. It's like the difference between a Star Wars sci-fi character and something from a Del Toro movie, you know, like that Angel of Death or whatever, or this guy, right? That guy.
Yeah.
Brilliant, right? That's not from nature. That's from imagination. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of fun. It's a different kind of challenge.
You clearly love working on these different monsters and aliens. How did you kind of get in, like, interested in doing these concepts based off of nature, like you're saying?
Well, I was very fortunate that my father was a big fan of special effects, and he was an artist. He dabbled, you know, in painting and drawing and stuff. But when he was in he was an insurance salesman, basically. That was his job. And when he lived in New York, his beat, you know, as an insurance salesman was 30 Rockefeller Center, where currently where Saturday Night Live is done, but it's been a TV. They've been doing TV there since TV started. So this would have been in the 1950s. And my dad told me the stories of going into these workshops in Rockefeller Center and meeting people like Dick Smith, who would later, you know, become the guy that did The Exorcist and The Godfather. And so my father had a kind of a knowledge of how some of this stuff was done because he had a glimpse behind the scenes. And he also knew something about stop motion animation because he had read up on it or saw that, you know. So he would let me watch things like Jason and the Argonauts, the Ray Harryhausen movie. I can remember him waking me up when I was about six. It was probably the network premiere of this movie on TV, and it was probably 9 o'clock. So I'd been asleep for an hour. And he said, "You got to come see this." So I'm standing there as a little kid and watching the guy throw the Hydra's teeth down onto the ground and, you know, saying, "Rise, children of the Hydra." And I'm like, "What the hell?" You know, and the skeletons burst up and it's so well timed, you know, that the pacing of that scene is so well timed that it just draws you in, and it's very gripping and suspenseful. and then just looking at those things, you're like, how the heck did they do this? You know, I can see through it. My first thought was, oh, there are people I've seen people in black leotards with bones painted on them, but no, you can see right through them. You know, what is it? And then he would say, oh, they're little tiny things. They're just little tiny puppets like that big. What? You know? So that like just my brain exploded and I always had a burning desire to understand how this stuff was done. And he was very encouraging of that. So Ray Harryhausen is probably the guy that, you know, when I was, you know, again, around 12 years old, and I saw an interview in Castle of Frankenstein magazine. And I was like, oh, there's on the cover was, I think, Talos from Jason and the Argonauts. Like, oh, I like that monster. And I'm flipping through going, oh yeah, that's one of my favorite monsters. That's one of my favorite. And then I realize it's one person that has done all these. And that's when I'm like another little moment of clarity. Yep. Yeah. I was a fan of that guy's art, you know, So to me, I always thought, well, that's what I want to be. This is the way I'm going to spend my life. And I was interested in stop motion, and that's what I started doing. And then, you know, along came Star Wars, and that kind of put puppets and animatronics and makeups in the forefront. And that was a technique that was being used more than stop motion. You know, we didn't really have the Leicas or the Tim Burton Nightmare Before Christmas, big opus, full stop motion movies. If that stuff had been going on at that time, I might have gone that route. But in retrospect, I'm glad it worked out the way it did and that I was flexible in my thinking, because to me, it's never really solely about the technique. It's about the character. It's about the result and the feeling that you want to get when you look at the movie, you know.
But do you feel like you have a specific approach now because of that? I mean, I understand that, you know, you've grown up with this specific style, and to you, this style is how you sort of bring that to life, rather than, let's just say, I mean, for example, puppeteering, animatronics, etc., compared to CGI. Like, how would you look at that sort of evolution of the different types of technology for these sorts of things over the years?
Well, definitely practical effects have been around since the birth of cinema, right? Like George Méliès, you know, the rocket sticking in the moon's eye and all that kind of stuff, you know. So it's a long tradition, and I came into onto the scene at a time where there was no CGI. So what I learned was the traditional arts. If I was coming along now, I'm sure I'd be into probably more of the digital stuff, because it's a quick way. I don't mean quick. I don't mean to be dismissive of it. There's, I think, too much is made of this like war between digital and practical, and there is no war. If you're a filmmaker, you're just picking and choosing tools to build your house, you know. It's just that I'm a product of my time, and that's where I put my focus. In terms of where things are now, I think we're in a really good place between practical and digital. I'm seeing many more digital artists embracing the practical aspect because they're fans too, and they, you know, they've seen the movies and they know like that looks real. The Queen Alien from 1986 still looks very, very real. It you don't look at it and you go, oh well, that technique has aged. You know, in the way that you do with, we've seen the evolution very clearly of CGI. You can look back, in fact, in Mortal Kombat, you know, the character of Reptile, that was the character that the producers were most excited about. They really thought they were onto something, and Goro was kind of a second-class citizen on that film. And they, you know, and I can remember at the time going, am I nuts? Or, you know, does that Reptile... You know, whatever. It's just what the technology was at the time. And they were very excited, you know.
Yeah.
In Hollywood, everybody wants to have some sexy new thing that they can promote. So if you're saying, I do traditional art, sometimes people sort of just, you know, go, oh, cool. You know, seen that before. You know, they all want the next new thing as opposed to like refinements of the existing in my opinion, real things. Always as a foundation, they will always give you reality. You can get there with digital. It's just very, very expensive. It's that Phil Tippett told me that the seduction of digital animation and characters is that you can get 80% of the way there really quickly, but that remaining 20% is super time consuming and very, very expensive.
Let's jump into your career a little bit. I mean, since we're kind of on this topic, you started off working with Stan Winston, like legendary Stan Winston, on movies such as Pumpkinhead. And then from there, you ended up co-founding Amalgamated Dynamics, ADI, with Tom Woodruff. Like this career path, I think, is amazing, in my opinion. How much of what you picked up from Stan Winston did you carry over into the formation of the ADI, which made a huge list of some of the most famous movies.
Well, I can back up a little bit before Stan Winston as well. I was in the business for 5 years before I started working for Stan. And in that, I started at Roger Corman's in 1980 in a movie called Battle Beyond the Stars. And I was working at, I told this story before, forgive me if anyone's bored with this, but I, at the time that I interviewed at Rogers, I was 19 years old and I was working in my mother's garage. I was living at home and she'd let me take over the two-car garage in Santa Ana. And I was doing stop motion and I was doing puppets and all this stuff. And my sister knew someone who was working on Battle Beyond the Stars for Corman. And he happened to see the garage and was like, oh my God. You got to come in and interview on this movie I'm working on. And I was like, oh shit, I'm 19 years old. I don't have a portfolio. I you know, I'm not a professional. So I was very insecure about it. So, I called a guy that I had met, probably maybe 6 months earlier, through a former art teacher, of mine from high school. She had met, her husband taught oceanography, and he met this guy who was a filmmaker, et cetera, et cetera. That guy was Jim Cameron. So I met Cameron in about, 79. In fact, he and I saw Alien, the first Alien, when it came out. We went to the movie theater in Orange County and watched it. We were like, holy shit, right? Like, this is unbelievable. I took Jim and I went to the interview because I thought, well, I'll bring him along because, you know, he's 5 years older than me. He's got like this portfolio. He's got beautiful paintings. He's got a freaking Xenogenesis. You can look it up on YouTube. There's a bad copy of it but you can kind of get an idea. Stop motion. He was just an unbelievably advanced genius. Right. And I felt like, well, I'm just a kid with some monsters. So we interviewed, and it took another 6 months or so to get hired. And later, Cameron told me, hey, you know why we didn't get hired? Because everybody thought I was an asshole. So it was his brash personality. I probably would have gotten hired earlier, but his brash personality, but they ultimately did hire us. And that was on Battle Beyond the Stars. So I was kind of working with him, you know, and he was climbing the ranks, you know, like we'd come in, we were model builders, right? Like, and Chuck Comiskey, the guy who hired us, the boss, said, hey, we need, there's one last spaceship to design. And so if anybody has any ideas, submit a sketch. So I'm like, oh, okay. You know, and so I did one and Cameron did one. And Cameron's, of course, it was the boob ship, right? With the and Cameron goes, and it's like, well, that is insane and excellent. Oh, yes, I see there's a woman's body in it because it had a female voice and it was named, I think it was called Mother. So of course, like, you know, that's the one we're going to build. So then he and I start building the ship, and then he moved into an art director position on the film. He would move. Oh, he started shooting. He got his own little unit, a VFX unit. And then I finished the spaceship along with a guy named Pat McClung, who's a great model builder. And then I moved to join Jim in his camera unit. So then I got to load film and work with the simple motion control system, et cetera, et cetera. And then I, when that job ended, I decided to go to film school, and I went to UCLA film school. And Cameron said, I don't think you should go to film school. What do you mean? He said, I think it's a waste of time. I think you can, there's nothing you're going to learn there. And I said, all right, mister, we'll see who goes further in this business. And after about maybe 2 years of that, I was working at Corman's and going to school, and I ended up dropping out of film school because I realized that, well, Roger Corman's was a better film school than any film school. Jim Cameron is how I was led to Stan Winston, because Jim told Stan, you got to hire this guy for Terminator. And unfortunately, I had to pass on that because I had already committed to Friday the 13th Part 4, and I was like, oh, dang, you know. Well, okay. Anyway, you know, Stan respected that I didn't jump ship, and he just said, call me when you're done. So I did, and that's when I started at Stan's. So I'm sorry to be so long winded, but to answer your question about,
don't apologize. This is what we want to hear.
So the question about did I carry lessons or what did I learn from Stan Winston's moving forwards? What I got from Stan Winston's, which was invaluable, was that Stan saw me as an experienced artist and technician who had James Cameron's stamp of approval. So I was automatically accepted into Stan's fold along with his four other regular guys. And Stan was great at delegating and giving you opportunities. If he trusted you, he would give you opportunities. He would say like, hey, I want you to, you know, Alec here, you're in charge of all the Bishop robot effects on Android effects on Aliens. You know, you got to figure out how we're going to split this thing in half. What's it look like? All that stuff. And, you know, I got to sculpt face huggers and paint all the skins of the face, most of them. And, you know, and then conversely, Tom Woodruff was doing, working on Eggs and the warrior suits and so on. So Stan saw that Tom and I got along very well, and he would tend to team us up on things. So it made sense eventually when it was time for us to leave Stan's. And the only reason that we left Stan's is that we had Tom and I had co-written a script that was getting some interest. And we thought, oh, good, this can be a Stan Winston studio movie. He's directed Pumpkinhead. You know, he wants to make movies. So we took it to him, and he explained to us that his main need for our talents was making monsters. And at that point, you know, I evaluated that and I thought, well, okay, so that means that's all I'm going to do. And Stan announced to the industry that he was only going to do effects for his movies that he directed. So that meant we would not be working with Bob Zemeckis or Steven Spielberg or even James Cameron. We'd be doing lower budgeted films. And I thought, I didn't come here to just plunk myself down in one place. I very much wanted to move and experience mm-hmm. and ultimately be my own man. So that's when I left with Stan's blessing. He was great. He's my, number one mentor. Mm-hmm. So it was all great. And then Tom followed me shortly after. And then the script that was getting us interest went nowhere. So we were like, oh, what the hell do we do now? Guess we better start making monsters. So we formed the company. So our joke was that ADI was founded on failure. So 34 years of ADI. So it's really not a failure, but I'm used to that, right? Like I'm used to like you get set back and then you figure out the way to make that an advantage and you move forward from there. But I got a lot of lessons. I didn't really get technical lessons from Stan. It wasn't like, here, I'm going to show you how to mix PAX paint or anything. Mm-hmm. I got thrown into the deep end, and that was fantastic. And
the best kind of experience.
Forever grateful to him. And then there was also lots of life lessons that he, because he was a very fatherly guy, had a lot of wisdom and things like, you got to have fun. He really encouraged everybody to have fun. He was not a dour artist Stan did not require you to bleed for your art. Like some people do that. Mm-hmm. Some people think that in order to do great things, you have to be tortured or you have to suffer or you have to starve or whatever. Stan was not about that at all. And I'm so glad to have been influenced by him in that way. And so that's why, that's part of why I just go ahead and indulge myself if you can have fun, you should have fun,
Of course.
Otherwise, you may as well have a regular mm-hmm. job and toil away somewhere in misery.
So, like we want so badly to talk about your other movies because I mean the list is huge and amazing. The Aliens movies, Alien 3, Aliens versus Predator, Predators, Prey, the brand new Hulu series, which is doing phenomenal. I mean, you've had a hand in all this with ADI. But if we have time, maybe we can circle back around to that. Let's just go ahead and jump into Mortal Kombat 1995, which you're known as being credited with the sculpting of everybody's beloved giant animatronic half dragon Goro from Mortal Kombat 1995. Did you know anything about Mortal Kombat before you got on this
really.
Project, or were you a fan at all?
Really. I've never played the game. I've never watched mm-hmm. any of the other movies other than the one that I worked on. I'm vaguely aware that there was a comic book because we had a couple of those, and we're just looking at what the different iterations of Goro have been. So I'm going to be kind of a boring interviewee when it comes
Not
to
at all.
Mortal Kombat.
I think you have some cool info to share with us, regardless of what you think.
If I may, I did sculpt Goro's head, but mm-hmm. I also I should also credit some of my other artists, like Andy Schoenberg. Andy Schoenberg, I sculpted Goro's head. We cast it up. We did a painted version. I painted one, and we presented it, put it on film, and they're like, the producers were like, he looks too old. And I was like, I was young. You learn pretty quickly that you got to do iterations, right? You're not just and you have a bunch of people to please. So I was like, I was really kind of defeated. So I took the sculpture and I said, Andy, can you please euthan him? So Andy, he took some of the eye bags out. And, he did some nice work on it too. So he gets some credit. Also, there's a guy named Ryan Peterson, who is an amazing sculptor, who was brand new. I think that might've been his first job. And I was like, I hate sculpting ears. Ryan, I need little baby ears like that big. Sculpt me two baby ears. And he sculpted them and I stuck them. But I did sculpt it. And then the body was sculpted by Norman Cabrera, Greg Smith. And it's so long ago. There's a third sculptor that maybe I'll think of. But anyway, oh, you had a great team on that.
Well, that's actually really cool to hear because I don't think any of those names have ever been mentioned alongside the creation of Goro to this level of detail. And it's good to hear all the team behind it. It's actually really cool.
There were articles, probably a Cinefex article maybe, where we always made sure to credit people who were in it. But it, you know, over time, it boils down to like, you know, there's a picture on Instagram of me sculpting the head and it kind of becomes, you know, it's the lightest thing. So, but yeah, no, we've always had phenomenal artists working for us and have been, you know, lucky.
Well, I'm curious then, because obviously you've mentioned you're not really a Mortal Kombat fan, and I'm interested in hearing what sort of information was actually shared with you prior to you working on him. Like what sort of idea did you have of him to get that visual really?
Well, I felt that it would be counterproductive, or at least if not that, a misuse of time for me to steep myself in the game, because that was more the screenwriter's job. I suppose the director could do that. But the fact is that for what I was doing, what we were trying to do was create a living, believable character. And I didn't feel there was a heck of a lot other than like, what's this guy look like? Oh, forearms, ponytail. What are the benchmarks of his look? But other than that, you know, I'm in my mind, I'm thinking of beyond that, who are the references that I'd like to see. There's an actor named Woody Strode. I don't know if you guys know who Woody Strode was, but I think he might have been an Olympic athlete, but he was in Spartacus. He was the black gladiator. I think he might be the guy that throws the spear or the trident, you know, and just barely misses the, but he's got, if you look him up, you look up Woody Strode, a close up of him. That's what I was going for. Like Woody Strode's a little more lean but he's chiseled and he's a cool looking guy. Right. So that's kind of what I wanted to do. Also, I wanted to do something that was stylized, but not so terribly stylized that it looked phony, you know? So proportioning the jaw, very big, a small nose. It's funny to me too, because that, I'm not saying that there was that sensibility of style and reality, the blend of style and reality. It's not entirely new, but it's funny to see that played out again. When I look at Thanos, I'm like, that's Goro. That face is Goro. And it's done beautifully, but it's following the same rules, right? And so is the Hulk. Mm-hmm. Sort of a likeness of a person transposed and warped and turned into. Mm-hmm. This was all before Photoshop, so I was fascinated with the idea of making something that couldn't possibly be a human being, but yet looked very real. And
yeah,
that's kind of what we were going for.
That's cool. I can, now that you mentioned that, and you're comparing it to these Marvel characters, I see, you know, basically how you tweak the anatomy of Goro to give him that stronger features, especially facial features and things like that. Like that makes a lot of sense. Were there any specific mannerisms or like personality that you and your team wanted to capture through his motions and various expressions? Because he was a very expressive animatronic that you guys
put together for this character. The way we work is that if we're doing an animatronic like that, you make it as expressive as you possibly can. You put as many points of movement in it as you can, with as much range of movement as possible. And then after that point, you play with it and find out what are the cool things it can do. You know, it can raise its eyebrows, you know, one eyebrow up. It can, you know, we make sure that the lower lids can squint without affecting the upper lids. Goro had dilating pupils. I think that's the first time that a human-sized eye that could dilate was done. We came up with a very clever way of doing that. And then you also, the body was so was such an unbelievable technological challenge for its time. You know, we only had 3 months to build this thing. And it had a telemetry device, you know, that a puppeteer would wear. Wow. So all of the puppeteer's arm movements and finger movements would be translated to the full scale, you know, to our puppet. And then Tom Woodruff was wearing that rig on his shoulders. His head was in Goro's chest. And then Tom's lower arms were Goro's lower. Tom's arms were Goro's lower arms.
Was it your studio that released that behind the scenes footage of him in the Goro suit?
Yeah.
I see exactly what you mean.
That one might have been, we'd have one where somebody punches him in the nuts and he goes, right, that whole thing. you have to rehearse those moments. You have to drill those moments over and over to get the character, you know. But we had another version of him that had bouncy arms, reactive bouncy arms. Mm. Tom could bounce around like a kickboxer or a boxer, and the arms, Goro's arms, would bounce along with him. So we thought that would be useful because we had to have an untethered version. You know, at the time we were.
Did you end up using that particular one, the bouncing one? Because I've seen a lot of backs behind the scenes footage, but on the movie itself, you don't notice him spring-loaded
there's a prominent
mechanism in the fight.
There's a prominent place you can see it where it's a high shot, like behind the audience, and the camera's tracking along, and people are in the foreground, and there's the ring down there, and they're squaring off, and Goro is doing that.
Yeah.
But Tom could also twist his body and get Goro to do hooks, you know, with that bent arm hooks. So it is in some of the fight sequences in cuts, but most of it, you're right, most of it is the hero, you know, fully articulated guy.
You clearly had a lot of experience within your line of work by this point, but I mean, you mentioned that he posed some specific challenges. Is it because he was sort of his own different type of project where you were trying something new or?
Yeah. I mean, he was really technologically cutting edge, and to only have 3 months to build. So we really should have had 6 months, but, it was a great deal of pressure and a great deal of stress. And we learned a lot, not only about the mechanics of it and about, you know, how to pull off a very sophisticated high-tech character, but also about communication with the production. Paul Anderson directed it. Great guy. We worked with him again then on AVP. And he's a terrific guy. And this was his Mortal Kombat was his second feature film. And Paul's very smart. He could look at it, watch us work with him, you know, watch a rehearsal and start getting an idea of how he can use him, because practical things have strengths and they have weaknesses. So you can't do everything with a practical, you know, it's going to have its limitations. I argue that those limitations are actually strengths because it forces you to present it like as if it was real, right? Like you can't, like you're never going to have that. Yeah. How many times have we seen CGI characters get up and, you know, they leap in the air, they leap to a wall, and then suddenly as soon as they're off their feet, they look like they have no weight. Things aren't, you know, it's wrong. Ridley Scott told us this when we worked with him. He said that the alien suit, the original alien suit that Giger made, it was beautiful in its design, amazing, groundbreaking, but it was made of latex and cheesecloth. So it's like a Halloween mask. It's not foam latex that's very supple. So the performer couldn't move very well in it. And Ridley had, in his mind, had thought of something that was super agile. And in one of the original scripts, there's a scene where the alien is fighting people at the airlock and picking him up and throwing him around. It's a very physical fight. And kind of like what we did in Prey recently. But Ridley realized, I can't do that. I have to change the way I shoot this. And he said, and thank God I had those limitations, because it made the alien so much scarier. It becomes more of like, you don't know where that thing is, because he could do some movements to get it, but they're all balletic and creepy, right? So he just went a different direction with it. And to to me, you know, the rest is history. So I don't mind those kind of limitations. We try to build and conquer those limitations and get rid of as many of them as we can, but they're always there.
That kind of reminds me of the work you ended up doing on Alien 3, where you ended up making an alien move with faster speed for the first time by using like your puppeteer techniques and things like that. Did a lot of these previous skills, how did they kind of compound into your creation of Goro? Because, I mean, you guys have done so many different movies by that point and done so many different techniques. Did some of these kind of influence how you tackled the Goro situation?
Unique, but we, at the time, because he's so technological and so sophisticated, and the systems that were required, you know, not only mechanical, but electrical motors, you know, high speed motors that were winding cable, mm-hmm. you know, big giant box full of these. If one of them, you know, the cables flew off the spool, you just hear it rattling around inside this giant box. Kill it. You know, it was like, oh. We also had a second Goro suit where we figured out how to do it all internally without a bundle of cables coming out of Tom's butt. And it was all internal. It was heavier, a little heavier, but it moved really beautifully. And it's in the film as well. So nothing had really prepared us for that level of sophistication. So it was kind of a standalone thing, which is why it was so stressful. And, you know, I wouldn't do it that way. We pitched a different way of doing it. We pitched something more like, you know, Tom in the floppy arm suit for full body stuff. And then we wanted to build a waist up version of Goro that would be hydraulic. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there would be nobody inside it. And that was not, the filmmakers didn't really want that. So
sort of upper body shots instead of a full.
It would be from the hips up. That would have been hips up. So you could have your wides would be a different sort of lightweight kind of stunt one. And then, but they wanted a man in a suit for the whole thing. But when I talk about communication, it's, you know, we ultimately were not on the same page with production. Because I would say things like Goro is a character, right? For the film, we want him to be a living, breathing character. And then the producer would go, oh yeah, like one of the actors. And I go, yeah, he's you can consider him story-wise like he's one of the actors. Well, to the producer, what that meant was he's like an actor. He'll just be sitting over there, and when we call him, he'll walk in. And so when we had like stand, you know, we had a gantry that we would have to like take this because it weighed 135 pounds on Tom's shoulders. Mom would put the lower legs on. We'd put this him on, you know, he'd so the producer was like, what's going on? You said he was going to be like an actor. And I'm like, he is. He's a character. He's one of the characters. So it's like, you know, totally different. So now for me, I'm always listening like, you know, wait a minute, they just said that. Let's not assume that we're speaking the same.
We have the same interpretation.
Yeah. So now I'll go like, when you say, what do you mean by? And then I'll kind of dig into it a little bit. And sometimes we discover some real, real miscommunications that way. And it almost becomes, I sometimes become very boring because I'm constantly trying to clarify things. And sometimes people are like, you're cagey, man, because you're like, oh, and I'm like, I'm sorry, I just don't want like any misunderstanding. I try to like, when we build something, now I try to kind of set the bar a little low, right? Like when they say like, you know, will the foam rubber hold up? Will it last? And I go, yeah, it'll last. I mean, unless you do something crazy with it, but let's not do crazy things. Let's not, you know, roll it down a mountain on the first day of shooting or whatever. Let's and we'll be okay. But yeah, rubber tears, and et cetera, et cetera. And in reality, the rubber is much tougher than that. I just don't want them to, you know, say, oh, well, Alex said we could do anything. Okay.
To test it.
Set it on fire. You know, we'll have 30 days of shooting, you know. So, anyway, communication is really extremely important. It's really the it's really, I mean, it's just, it is what everything is about. It's about, you know, communicating, you know, in the behind the scenes. If you have to really be on the same page with these things. Like, I don't really like it so much when people say like, just do your thing, man. You're the expert, do it. And they're like, yeah, I'm the expert, but you're my client and I need to hear from
you. Yeah. Like those sorts of complications are always going to be things that you're going to have. And it's interesting to see the sort of approach you have to take to deal with those things. But I'm curious now that, you know, when you're done with these sorts of projects, I mean, even specifically the Goro animatronic, looking back on this, how does it feel knowing that all these years later, that that crazy project you did where you had to deal with all these issues has is held in such high regard by the Mortal Kombat community, which you're not even a fan of personally, but it's still something in really in history. How does it feel to look back on getting past all those obstacles?
It's really unbelievable to me because honestly, we, as I mentioned, Goro was a second class citizen. He did not get much love on set. He didn't get it from the producer team.
That's so shocking.
There's an actor who I can't remember even what part he plays, but there's a YouTube video of an actor and it was shot right after the movie. So whatever, but he's sitting on a beach somewhere and he's talking about what a misfire Goro was, how terrible Goro was. And really it's coming from an actor's point of view where he's saying like, we have to wait around. You know, like, because actors coming in and everyone going, you know, and then so you put this technological beast of a thing in with a scene with actors, and you're like, okay, we got to pull Tom out of the suit because, you know, he's been in it for 45 minutes straight. He needs to rest or he needs to sit on a slant board. And then all of a sudden the actor's like, you know, and I'm like, I don't mean that about all the actors, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't mean that. But look him up. Look up this one guy on YouTube and you'll see it. And it's funny. And I'm exaggerating also. He's not that disparaging, but that's where my sensitivities were. When I'll tell you, one of the producers, when we wrapped Goro, the last thing we shot was like some green screen stuff of him falling, against the green screen. And then we were done. And we were up on this platform shooting. And the producer says, normally when people are done, you know, when a job is, an actor finishes or whatever, they go, it's so-and-so's last day, yay, right? So his version of this resentful producer's version was, all right, everybody, Goro is wrapped. And then he turns to Goro, who has my business partner, Tom, inside it. And I'm standing there and he goes, fuck you, Goro.
That was his send
off. So for years.
Yeah, the appreciation or lack of.
Let me tell you one other thing. Sorry.
Yeah.
They tried to sue us. The production, they threatened to sue us. They hauled us to the studio and sat us down. Oh. We had to bring our lawyer. And they went through all these examples of why Goro cost the production tons of money. And one of the things they pointed out was, you know, all the candles in the set? There were a ton of candles, 300 candles or something. They said that because Goro took longer to shoot than we promised, they had to buy more candles than expected. So here's a... here's a $200 bill for candles, right? And they said they were trying to charge us, like they have something called a standby carpenter on sets, right? That standby carpenter's job is to come in and, you know, cut things and build things real quickly, all that. We needed a hole cut in a wall so that we could run our cables through it. So the standby carpenter cut a hole. That was a bill for that gentleman's time, right? Like this is unheard of. This is part of the production. These are your costs, people. Like, you don't try to bill. It's so petty, right? And then they also said that they spent money digitally fixing Goro's lip sync. And when I watch the movie, I'm like, I don't see any sign in that era. I don't see any signs of digital touch-ups or anything like that. So I think what happened was the movie may have gone over budget. and and a couple of the producers may have decided that they needed to save some face with the studio and say, well, it's that guy, it's Goro's fault, you know, it is sort of pin it on us. So that's the kind of risk, that's the PTSD that I carried with me from that movie. And this has nothing to do with the director. He was fantastic. All the actors were terrific. It was just a couple of people in key positions that were, I think, trying to, you know, do a little of this, you know, and that's another valuable lesson. They failed at it because there was no pace there, but they tried. So anyway, the only reason I tell you all this is that for many years, I felt very self-conscious about it. And I thought, I just didn't want to watch it. I thought, well, Goro must be a piece of crap. And it wasn't until Richard Taylor from Weta, you know, Peter Jackson's partner in that, who's won 5 Oscars or whatever, he came through our studio. And one of the things, first things he said was, I got to tell you, Peter Jackson and I, when we were teenagers, we got a VHS of Mortal Kombat and we wore it out because we watched it 90 times and we would just rewind to the Goro scenes and until the tape broke. And I was like, I hugged him like, oh my God, it's so nice to hear that. So it blows my mind that people look at Goro and go like, that is an awesome thing, because I just didn't feel very good about it.
I love Goro, like in the movie. I've heard a couple people, you know, kind of talk about the effects with him and stuff like that. But I'm like, it's a 95 movie and he was a fantastic. And one of my favorite scenes is him with Kano in the Shang Tsung's lair thing, sitting at the throne and doing his lines, and the way that he would just kind of act them out. I was just like, this is a real character. And seeing the behind the scenes footage is unbelievable to me, because he looks so real and so fantastic.
I'm glad you felt that way. That was always the goal. And the movie has also got a charming kind of heightened style to it, you know, the sets stylized and what. So it's kind of a kid's movie, you know, and I think Goro fits very nicely into that. One last little bit about communication. There was another little miscommunication. Same guy who flipped us off at the end. Said, I kept saying, you're going to have a second unit, right? And he goes, oh, yeah. I said, good, because, you know, these animatronics, what you want to do is you want to have a camera unit with fewer people so that we can nail it. We can get them. If you're just on Goro, there's no reason to have the whole crew and the cast, right? He goes, we're going to have a second unit. Yeah, don't worry about it. The second unit. We got the schedule. I'm looking. There's no second unit schedule. What is this? What he meant was a second camera. So while we were shooting Goro, they have a B camera sitting there shooting him. That's not a second unit. That's very different from a second unit. So what they did was they're like, oh, no, we only have two weeks to shoot Goro. And I'm like, well, that's not enough. You have not scheduled enough time. And that's why, you know, we were slogging through that with everybody standing around feeling, you know, them feeling abused and us feeling like we're inconvenienced. So anyway, boy, I don't think I've ever told these stories publicly, guys.
It's actually awesome to hear, honestly. You said to me, I don't think I have anything good for you on Goro, and here we are.
Well, if you asked me about, you know, Goro's favorite signature moves or whatever from the game, I wouldn't have much to say.
No, that's not what we generally ask on the Realmcast, don't worry.
So recently you teamed up with an artist, Michael Vincent, to create these digital composites of the original Goro bust. Is there any chance that we're going to see the light of day for this project? Like, is it going to become some kind of collectible or downloadable STL file? Because it's a beautiful piece and fans want it, I'm sure.
It's a really good question. I have the pieces all printed and I want to assemble them and finish it off, you know, and put the pictures up and see what happens. I don't really have a master plan for it. It's just that I love the character. I think it would be something that people would dig on, but to at least see pictures of it.
Oh,
I don't really have plans for it, but who knows?
I want one. To let you know, right? Both of us.
we scanned everything, right? And so it's the head that I sculpted along with Andy Schoenberg and Ryan Peterson. So, you know, we could make little tiny ones. Or as you said, we could release the files and people could print their own. Mm-hmm. You know.
Yeah, I'd buy the file or I'd buy the statue. Mm-hmm. You just tell me, and I'm picking one up.
I mean, it's full scale, you know. So it sits big.
Cool.
You know, his head is, well, his head's, you know, a normal human sized head.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's amazing.
Now, considering everything you've just mentioned about what I would like to call a lack of appreciation or understanding, I suppose, for everything that went into Goro, I don't blame you for not actually being much of a fan of the series or keeping up with it. But I'm curious if you're aware of the fact that both Alien and Predator actually made it into Mortal Kombat X specifically. Oh, have you heard about that?
That's right. Yes, I was aware of that. Yeah. Yeah.
Because I thought you might find it interesting, because what they did with Alien was they actually made a variation of Alien, which was mixed with one of the species of Mortal Kombat, basically, to have sort of two characters in one.
That sounds kind of like a way to avoid a copyright lawsuit. Clever.
You know, but this is kind of playing off of two what you ended up doing with Alien 3, like and Aliens versus Predator Requiem. You made basically the first alien hybrids, and you know that's still kind of going off of all mm-hmm. that of this alien hybrid of with the Mortal Kombat characters.
Yeah, well, that's a great thing about the Xenomorph is that it morphs, right? And our idea was for Alien 3 was that it not only takes on characteristics of its host, but also of its environment. So, so in Fincher's version, cool. You had a lot of like sepia-toned concrete walls that it didn't have all of the detail of the spaceship in the first film, or the nuclear power plant in the or the terraforming plant in Aliens. So we thought, well, we can kind of back off on a lot of the mechanical parts of the biomechanical, keep enough there that it's Giger, you know, that it looks like Giger stuff. But there's a lot of Giger paintings that have repeating forms that are more organic, that are bony, or that look like antelope antlers or something like that, that don't really specifically look like mechanical parts. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've seen the, you know, on Aliens, we got one of the suits, Giger's suits, was shipped to us for reference. And you could see that he used car parts in places. And you could see the, you know, the little Mercedes-Benz lettering on the car part. So that's how mechanical he was going. And it's amazing. But we kind of felt like the character does morph, so we should take advantage of that and put it in. And so as a result, like, you know, by the time of Alien Resurrection, all of those characters have human DNA in them. So they're mm-hmm. even fleshier looking. And mm-hmm. So some people, because that doesn't necessarily come across overtly in the script, we got a lot of negative comments from people that we were, you know, messing with Giger's stuff too much. And we think they call it beast style or something like that. And it's just simply that it was part of the story, part of the subtext of the story.
I love how it all has a inspiration to it. Like every design piece you've done, like it traces back to the anatomy and things like you're saying at the beginning of the show.
And that, so we're always thinking about story and, but sometimes that's at odds with what fan expectation is or fan desire. You know, they very often there's a vocal minority of people who will be the first to start speaking up about things. And they kind of create an impression that that's what the fans think. But the fans really aren't necessarily a totally unified front. You know, you've seen everybody like has varying opinions and all that. And I think there's room for all of that. And there certainly is room for it in the visuals, because if you're just doing the same thing over and over and over, then you're going to lose a lot of people, I think. And I want to explore these. These characters are fantastic. Giger's design was absolutely genius. You know, that's not something that would come out of my brain. He had a unique, twisted vision that
sort of biomechanical style
and a completely fully formed visual language before Ridley Scott discovered him. I remember Brain Salad Surgery, the Emerson, Lake and Palmer album cover, when I was in junior high, looking at it going, what the hell? And the like Debbie Harry stuff, you know, that he did back in the 70s. So I was aware of this guy. And then what Ridley Scott did was say, I want that thing and put it in this movie. And it's unbeatable because this guy's life work was developing that language of biomechanical. And you don't really get that opportunity in a movie. In a movie, you're like, you have 3 months or 4 months, you know, like now go, you know, rock the world. And you're like, Stan Winston did it with the Predator, though. He did it. We had like 6 or 8 weeks to build that Predator suit. I worked on it. I didn't do a whole heck of a lot on the first Predator, but you know, Stan created that design, and then he had some really talented people. Steve Wang and Matt Rose were the main sculptors on that, and they brought a lot of design sensibility to it as well. But that character is unbelievable and iconic as well.
The Predator had some alien influence, and I remember reading something that he wanted to go with something with mandibles.
Yeah, there was around that time, what was it? Maybe we had done Monster Squad before or after that. I don't know. I can't really remember what. Oh, well, Pumpkinhead was going on while Predator was going on. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, Stan was sketching and, you know, Stan was really collaborative. He was really, what do you think? What do you think of this? What do you think of that? And so we would kind of throw things out there. There's a famous story where Cameron said, you should do something with mandibles. And then Stan interpreted that, you know, the way he did. But Stan was an excellent designer and an artist himself. But he did, as I mentioned, he delegated to people, which was a wonderful thing for all of us, you know.
Yeah. I'm curious that because of your focus on practical effects and such, and obviously we've mentioned that now there's a very heavy focus in the film industry on CGI, and we actually saw that circling back around to Mortal Kombat. You mentioned that you're not completely up to date. Well, you're not up to date with Mortal Kombat, but have you seen the new Goro in the new movie?
No. Did I see it? I haven't seen the movie. Yeah. No. I can't picture him right now. I don't think I have.
Okay. Yeah. Well, all right. No, because he was, as far as I understand, very CGI. Definitely a departure from your and your team's take on Goro in MK 1995. And he looks cool. Don't get me wrong. But I think there's a huge group of fans, including ourselves on the show, who very much prefer the 95 version of Goro. But I was very curious to see if you'd seen him.
No. Yeah. I haven't. I did like the version of him in Ready Player One that looked very much like our version, and that was fun to see a CGI version of him. I thought he looked pretty good with a chest burster coming out of him. So two things I've learned.
Yeah, two in one.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, Alec, you know, we gotta let you go soon, but we want to give you a chance to talk a little bit about your new studio, Studio Gillis, which congratulations by the way. But
congratulations. Yeah.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about this. How come you decided to branch off and create a brand new studio focusing on practical effects?
Tom and I have had ADI for now 34 years. And we've been over the last, I mean, we've always been our own people, right? Like we kind of like, neither of us got into the industry to be married to somebody, right? But it was a great partnership, and we got a lot of great stuff done and had a lot of success. But we've, you know, in the last 10 years or so, especially been sort of branching off doing our own thing. We both directed feature films and et cetera, et cetera. So there kind of comes a time. Tom moved back east where he's from, and you know, he's decided to focus on writing and directing and producing as well as creating his own artwork. You know, I think he really wants to get back because a lot of what we do in this business when you're working on a big show is you aren't directing. You don't necessarily have your hands on it, in it. You know, it's a very admirable and natural thing to want to get back to those roots and and do, you know, sculpt and all that kind of stuff. I, on the other hand, still, I have my personal projects, but I still enjoy working with teams of people, and I like just having a big studio with talented people in it and just doing cool stuff. I think that's great. I don't really love the business side of it. Is kind of a grind, and you know, gets to be a little not. It's, that's not why I got into this, but it's a reality. So we just thought, oh, maybe it's time to like branch out and do our own thing now. And this is my version of my own thing. So that's Studio Gillis. Did you guys like the logo?
Yeah. Looked really cool. I saw the little video that you posted as well, like where you said, there's something I forgot to say. And then you meant the full text in the post.
Carrying the empty notebook around. I was going to cross my arms, but I realized, oh no, it's up. The logo's up here. So I'm very excited about it. We're going to continue doing what we've been doing. You know, it's not like it's a big personnel change or anything like that. We're going to continue what we're going to do. We're going to keep the same workbenches. In fact, I am moving to a large studio space so that we'll be able to accommodate more work. And I just really like Prey is an example of a movie that just went really well. It was just a wonderful group of people led by the director, Dan Trachtenberg. And we were able to do a character that I think has somewhat of a fresh take on it, but it's still deeply inspired by the brilliant work of Stan Winston and Kevin Peter Hall. We have a pretty new suit performer named Dane DeLegro inside the suit, who is just an absolute beast of an athlete and really a creative performer as well. And so everything was kind of working, you know. And actually, you mentioned Michael Epinette, who I did the Goro, you know, the Goro scan and bust with. I brought him on that as our key creature designer, and he's a pleasure to work with. And he and I speak the same language. We're both very much into nature and biological evolution of things and the reasons for various functions, and you know, and we had a bunch of ideas, you know, that as you always do, there are ideas that don't make it to the screen. But but the greatest thing about Prey was that the director, his mandate was, I don't want this to look like other predators, and that we don't hear that all that often. You know, we usually hear, there's usually someone from the studio who's very protective of the original and wants it to be more like the original because it's safer, you know. But what we wanted to do with this character was to create that feeling that you had when you saw the first movie, which is what, you know, ugly motherfucker. Yeah. You know, it's got to shock you. It's got to have a new level of scare. So Dan said he wanted something that was looked more like a horror character, and I thought that's a great. As a designer, I can lock onto that. We can find something there.
I'm curious, since you mentioned Prey, mind if we jump into that real quick? What was the inspiration behind making this Predator's version, the bone helmet, which I thought was very unique and very cool looking?
Yeah. Well, it all gets back to its primitive nature, right? So this story takes place 300 years ago. So we knew from the script, it was built into the script, that his weaponry was not as evolved, right? He doesn't have a plasma gun or a nuclear bomb on his, it's the precursors to those things, right?
Gotcha.
So we want the audience to go, oh, he's got a gun that fires steel bolts instead of, you know, but they're smart, you know, they're guided, right? So that's
cool. Yeah.
But we didn't want any energy weapons, you know. And then his instead of having a nuclear bomb, he's got little, you know, landmines with shrapnel flechettes and, you know, that tear people apart. So it's a little more gritty and nasty. And he is a
visceral kind of
visceral. He's like a hand to hand John Wick, The Raid kind of, you know, inspired kind of character, which is, again, just to mention Dane DeLegro in the suit, he was able to really pull that shit off. And that's a that's not an easy task in a suit like that, you know?
I did want to ask actually about that, because I read that there were two suits. There was an animatronic suit and a stunt suit.
We actually made six suits altogether.
Oh.
We made six suits and we had multiple heads. So we had stunt heads. We had two hero animatronic heads. Because what happens with a show as physical as that, it's really not like you're on a sound stage and the creature's just sort of appearing and looking cool. He's actually in the mud. He's sunk in the mud. He's running around mm-hmm. in the wilderness of Calgary. And we're like, this thing's, and in broad daylight, you know?
Yeah.
And we're like, you know, these things are going to get trashed pretty quickly. So we need multiples of them.
Wow. Six suits. Didn't expect that.
Yeah. Well, you asked about the bone. You asked about the bone mask, and that is important. So the bone mask was a reaction to that too. Like, well, we've downgraded his weapons or de-evolved his weapons. We should de-evolve the predator as well. Right. So his, mm-hmm. his actual physiognomy. So we started playing with what we were calling the Neanderthal predator at first.
Yeah,
and he was
that
sort of
wide brow.
Yeah, and we were just looking at him. Oh, he just, you know, it just didn't look very elegant. You know, we still wanted something wicked, and he just looked a little clunkier. And that wasn't the director wanted something very slender but muscular and all that. So we went in a different direction, and we utilized the eyes are mechanical, so that we're not like, you know, if you use the human eyes as the original was, and we did it, you know, on AVP, then you can't mess with the spacing. You also have this high forehead that you have to deal with.
Yeah.
But if you can pull those out and, you know, not worry about a human's head, you can slope the forehead back. You can have more fun with the design and make them a little less human and a little more wicked. So that's what we were going for. And then the bone mask is like, we were trying not to have too much metal on him, you know, again, to try to say that he's a little more primitive. So the bone mask, the idea is that he has found something that, you know, a creature or something, or some part of a skull of a creature that he's cut open and hollowed out, and it fits him. And he's put his technology into it, you know, laser sight and all that. So he does have technology. It's just not quite as advanced as what you've seen the other predators have. So that was the
thought. We both loved Prey, and I mean, pretty much everybody that's seen it has loved it at this point. It's like Hulu's number one ranking premiere ever. So
93% of Rotten
Tomatoes. Yeah, congratulations.
Yeah. Amazing. Yeah. Really.
I should give a shout out to our fantastic visual effects supervisor, Ryan Cook, who I think this is a great example, a good model of practical and digital overlap on the creature itself.
Yeah.
Some people are like, I didn't even think it was a guy. I didn't think it was a human being. I don't, you know, and that's good, because that's what we were going for, was to disguise the human form enough. He's still a humanoid, and we did definitely have expression in the face and all that. But there are times where Ryan has enhanced that practical, never like an entirely digital version, but enhanced, you know, to make the eyes more intense, you know, to sometimes you just, you know, you're moving fast and the lighting is such that the eyes disappear a little bit, but that, you know, the intensity of eyes, I see some things where they've put some movement in the brows. Certainly when he roars, there's one shot that you keep seeing where he roars and there's a little shaking inside the mouth. All that stuff was discussed early on, and some people ask, like, oh, were you getting worried that they were going to replace? No, not with this group, because the only way to do this was to have a practical foundation that is enhanced by digital. There's the close up of the hands where he's holding the ash. I don't know if you're, that's a digital hand.
Yeah.
And that's cool.
Okay.
Because it's got all the points of movement that you want. Like when we do a glove, we extend the fingers a little bit, right? And give them some fingernails. We make the fingers a little longer to make them, you know. But you have a finger cup that the actor has to slide his finger in, and that means that it kills this joint. So you get this movement, but you don't get that movement, right? So in an extreme close up, that kind of shows. So that's where the fully digital hand is like, yeah, that's more expressive. And they have all, you know, they scanned all of our work so that they could keep it accurate. All that. But yeah, so I really enjoyed that process, and I think that it's another good one for me. Personally, the best examples of digital and practical overlap that I've worked on would be Prey, Starship Troopers, AVP, and of course Death Becomes Her, because it was the early days of that, and we had a lot of
pieces in that. Alec, do you have any other dream projects that you'd like to be a part of, or any projects coming up that fans can check out episode comes out?
We have two more. ADI has two more projects that we've shot that will be coming out. One is called I'm a Virgo. It's an Amazon series that's written and directed by Boots Riley, who did Sorry to Bother You. We worked on that one as well. And it's a really, it's a really strange and fun idea. I can't tell you too much about it, but you should be seeing that one. And then we also have a werewolf movie called Year Two, which is directed by Stephen Miller, and it's a werewolf pandemic movie. So we built a bunch of werewolves for that, and Frank Grillo fights them.
Okay.
Yeah. Those are coming out. Dream projects. It's always the next one. You know, it's always the next one. I'm hoping to do another film soon, direct another film. I've just finished a script. We've got a couple things in the hopper. I also have a film that I produced and did the creature effects for that is currently titled Wellwood. I'm not sure if we're going to change that title, but we should be, it's almost finished, and we should be ready to take it to market soon. So hopefully you guys will enjoy that one.
Lots of cool content on the way then. Very excited to hear that. Yeah. You've mentioned, and we've brought this up a couple of times, you're not a big fan of Mortal Kombat. And we normally ask our guests what your favorite finisher is. So I'm going to change the question for you and say, what is your favorite finisher from Mortal Kombat, Alien, and Predator, because they totally count as Mortal Kombat characters now.
Oh, I see. Why did it funny? Yes, I want to make sure I don't ruffle any feathers. It's not that I'm not a big fan. That doesn't mean that I think it's there's anything wrong or that I just never got into it. Just to clarify. I thought it was hilarious that nobody thought to punch Goro in the nuts in his 1,000 years of life. or that he would reach a cup. You could easily hide a cup under that loincloth. That was my friend Lyndon Ashby played that part. That was a lot of fun. So finisher. Let's see. Finishing moves. What are some of the creative ones? Boy, in Prey, there are some really fun deaths, aren't there?
Oh yeah.
I mean, it's all the, everything you could want. I think maybe, my favorite Predator kill is the netball in Prey when he throws the thing at the guy. And we designed that thing and came up with the logic behind it, that it fires this metal mesh net, and then it contracts by spooling it back in. But the execution of it was so fun, right? With that ball sitting under the log, just going, it sounds like a lawnmower or something, and everything just popping and shredding. And the fact that it's off screen too, it's implied what's going on. But I'm going to say that's my favorite finishing move for Predator.
That's a pretty cool one, and actually doubly cool by the fact that it is somewhat reminiscent of Cyrax, one of the cyborgs in Mortal Kombat. He has a net which basically burns the opponent through, right through, cubes them. So that's pretty cool.
Hey, when did they come up with that one? Because Paul Anderson had that in AVP also, in a net that...
That was...
Yeah.
Oh, and the guy walks
through... I think Predator 2 might have had something similar.
The guy walks through a mesh, right? Yeah. And was that an AVP or was that in a different?
Yeah,
that was an AVP.
An
AVP, it gets thrown on him. I'm not sure which one that was from.
So there's one character who walks and gets cubed, but that maybe that's not AVP. Maybe that's Resident Evil.
Yeah, Resident Evil, Wes Anderson's. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Paul Anderson, yeah. I would like to see Wes Anderson.
Oh, sorry, yeah.
Wes Anderson directing a Resident Evil movie.
That would be pretty cool.
Very, very good color tones. Yeah.
Bill Murray. Jeff Goldblum.
Alec, before we let you go, where can our listeners find you?
Well, you know what I would say? Instagram, Alec_Gillis. There's always that. If you're interested in behind the scenes stuff, if you're unaware of the ADI YouTube channel, you can just look up on YouTube, look up Studio ADI's channel. And we have over 300 videos there, and there's Mortal Kombat stuff, Goro stuff, Alien stuff, Predator stuff, tons and tons. You could waste a weekend for sure.
I do. I've definitely done that. I actually mentioned that exact channel, I think, earlier. So we'll be leaving links to all of those in the description for anybody who wants to go and check this out. And trust me, you really should if you haven't seen any of this stuff before.
We'd like to thank all of our listeners for stopping by the Realmcast. And Alec, thank you so much for joining us on this episode. It's been a pleasure to have you on the Realmcast and get to talk to you about these movies.
I appreciate it. I had a wonderful time. Thank you.
As did we. Thank you so much.
Yes. You can find Yanni and myself, Phantom, on the Mortal Kombat group on Facebook, as well as Yanni on the Mortal Kombat Meme Realm, which is also on Instagram.
You can also join our official Discord channel hosted on Mortal Kombat Online server through the link in the description, where we discuss Mortal Kombat along with our listeners.
Special thanks to Uppercut Editions for their continued support. The Realmcast is the official podcast of Mortal Kombat Online.
And you can catch up on all episodes of the Realmcast on YouTube, Facebook, iTunes, Spotify, and MortalKombatOnline.com. Thank you.